I'd first like to thank Paul for arranging this meeting. It's always a pleasure to be in Cambridge. It's such a beautiful city. So I thought I'd put up my favourite screensaver. This sort of illustrates, these are really quite remarkably accurate in terms of the sort of beautiful array of patterns that you get on fish. And importantly, two of the fish that I'm going to be talking to about today are on here. So this is the Kuran angelfish. I'll be talking about this one. It's a juvenile angelfish. This is Pomacanthus imperator. If you want to impress people, that's the emperor angelfish. But there's a whole range of sort of like beautiful patterns illustrated by this screensaver. So, Okay, so as I say, today I'm going to be talking about modelling pigmentation patterns in fish. And this is really what got me interested in the whole area of growing domains quite a few years ago now, actually. So it's an area that I'm actually kind of, I haven't really been looking at too much lately, but recently I've got very much back into the problem of pigmentation patterns in fish. So it's sort of like very much revisiting it. So just sort of, I'm going to start with sort of like a few minutes sort of like on background about why we're studying these sort of problems. I realise this is probably a fairly mathematical background, so I thought I'd give you some sort of background to the why we're so interested in this problem. Modelling pigmentation patterns is really a problem of developmental biology. Why do we study development? Well, study it for a lot of reasons. One is to understand the development and the growth of organisms. And of course, it's an incredibly complex problem. This just shows a sequence in a very, very common lab animal in development, the zebrafish. You start off with a single fertilized cell. You go through a lot of process, a lot of rapid division, go through a lot of stages until you eventually form a fully complex organism, complete with sort of like internal structure and everything. And just to show a movie of this process, it's showing sort of like the stages between around here and here. So we're starting at this stage here. The single cell has actually divided once, and in this process you go through, what happens is the cells go through this rapid division stage initially. There's not really actually any real change in the volume, it's just dividing and dividing, and the cells are getting smaller as they divide. And then you go through sort of like a lot of very complex structural changes. The embryo spreads around the egg, beginning to form internal structure here. It's sort of beginning to form the backbone, and this is a sort of a stage called three-quarters epiphyte. And during this process, of course, there is a huge amount of growth going on. There's a huge amount of sort of like deformation. So obviously, but it's at the same time, it's an extraordinarily robust process. So even for species like fish, this process works correctly so many times, so it's an incredibly robust process. Okay. So as I say, we study it because we want to understand how organisms grow. We could study it in things like the zebrafish, but our real interest, of course, is understanding about humans grow. This is an early Leonardo da Vinci drawing, of a fetus growing inside the mother. We want to discover the origins of various genetic disorders. We also want to understand how cells interact and regulate, so how they coordinate themselves. And of course, that's to give us insight about various pathological conditions, such as cancer. Okay, so as I said, most of the studies in development are done on a set of model organisms. Zebrafish here, other typical model organisms are the chick, Dictyostelium, a type of amoeboid cell, Drosophila, the fruit fly, various others. And we tend to study in these model organisms, but why can we do that? Well, if you look across a lot of different species here, in the early stages, different species show very, very similar processes of development. So one of these embryos is going to turn out to be a human. I'll leave it to you to guess which of those it is going to be, but you can. But we've got everything here from sort of fish and amphibians right through to types of mammals, birds, and human here. Can't really tell at that stage. A little bit later on, well, probably going to can rule out this one. You can probably rule out this one. Going to be rather unfortunate human if it is one of those. But the rest are still very, very similar in terms of their embryonic development. It's only really right at the very, very much later stages in development where we really begin to see the individual variation from these species. So by using a number of model species across different species, we're able to get insight into how the embryo forms. Okay. So within the whole area of development, and this sort of leads to pigment patterning, is the particular area of morphogenesis or pattern formation in the embryo. So this is basically how the embryo acquires its form. And there's lots of beautiful examples of this in embryo. This is a process called somatogenesis. Here, the sort of regular stripes are showing an expression of a particular gene, but each one of these marks is like a little block of cells, and you get these form in a very sequential and regular pattern, moving down this way. And that basically sets up as like a blueprint of how the body is going to organize in the future. So it's a very, very important process. But it develops in a very regular way. This is an example of what's called planar cell polarity. These are sensory bristles on the abdomen of the Drosophila fruit fly, but they're basically hairs that all point in a specific direction, and they're used by the fruit fly to get various information about the environment. This is a process called segmentation. I think this is a grasshopper larvae or something. But again, this is an embryo that has been stained for showing the different gene expression. Again, you see some very, very structured coordination. Later on, of course, this is a zebrafish larva, not far off adult stages, and this has been stained to show the blood capillary network in the zebrafish. And you can see it forms in an extraordinarily regular and very organized way. So morphogenesis, the development of pattern and form. Okay, so there's been a number of models for morphogenesis, and I'm going to talk about two of them principally, one of which I think most of this audience will know about, maybe the other less people are aware of. So the first idea was the idea of the Turing model. So Alan Turing in 1952 considered a hypothetical system of reacting and diffusing chemicals. So in its simplest form, just have two chemicals, U and V. They undergo diffusion. They have some sort of reaction kinetics. And what Turing was very elegantly able to demonstrate was that if this reaction occurred in a certain way, certain conditions under the diffusion, then rather than diffusion being a process leading to homogenization, it could actually give rise to pattern formation. So I was able to demonstrate, and this is a mathematical model of a Turing reaction equation, that you could get patterns appearing in space, so regions of high concentration and regions of low concentration. So Turing came out with this back in 1952, and proposed it as being a model for how morphogenesis could occur. Very much seized upon, it was a very elegant theory. It was applied to a lot of different cases in development, a lot of other areas as well. One of the problems was, and why it really took a long time before it really was accepted by the biological community, is because we couldn't actually find any evidence of these. Couldn't even find them in an actual chemical reaction, in a pure chemical reaction alone, until about the late 80s, early 90s, when people discovered, actually mainly by accident, in a reaction called the SEMA chemical reaction, that these sort of patterns really can occur in real chemical systems. And must be said, though, the SEMA reaction is not the sort of reaction that's actually going to be going on in your body. If you have the chemicals involved in here, you know, it wouldn't do you much good. But it does show you that these aren't just sort of a hypothetical scenario. They really can occur. Okay. So the next sort of model for morphogenesis that I'm going to talk about is what we call generally call a mechanochemical based model. And the one I'm going to talk about is based on the idea of chemosensitive movement. The chemosensitive movement is the migration of cells or organisms in response to a chemical species. So basically, the cells will move, migrate in response to the chemicals they're detecting. There's a number of examples. Chemotaxis is basically the migration oriented by a chemical gradient. So the cell detects some chemical gradient and it responds by moving either up that gradient or down it. Chemokinesis is another example of chemosensitive movement. That's when cells move in response to a chemical concentration. So this is basically, I'm talking about it in terms of individual cells of the body here, but this is sort of like a much more general thing. If somebody was to open a pizza box probably over there, then the various of the smell coming to it, we could probably all, even if we were blindfolded, eventually get over and find where that pizza box was just by detecting the smell and moving towards it. You'd probably sort of clatter through a few desks along the way, but you would be able to get there. And there's a lot, in addition to chemicals are the most ubiquitous in the developmental biology, there's lots of other cues that also provide cells with the necessarily stimuli to tell them where to go. Okay, so, well, chemotaxis, just to sort of give you an idea of how it actually works, well, it's probably best demonstrated by how it works in various bacteria, such as E. coli. So this is an E. coli, it's in some sort of liquid medium, and E. coli is basically a small rod-like bacteria, and attached to it, it's got a bunch of sort of like long extrusions which are attached to the body. So what E. coli does, it has a process where it rotates these either clockwise or anti-clockwise. If they're all rotating anti-clockwise, it results in them bundling together, and the E. coli is able to move forward in a straight run. It then starts rotating some of them clockwise. The result of it, they all spray outwards, and it just sort of randomly reorients in space. And basically, it will then move through this process of what's called run and tumbling, so moving in straight lines followed by reorientation. And the way it is able to respond to chemicals through chemotaxis is it changes the length of the run time when it's moving up a gradient in the chemical. So it will move longer when it's moving up. And the result of that is it's able to sort of very quickly organize itself in response to chemical cues. So if you have a population of these organisms, you have some sort of source coming from a pipette of a chemoattractant, the result will be the cells will start to move towards it and aggregate at that source. And it's actually able to give rise to a number of very sort of pattern aggregations. So these show some E. coli that are in a petri dish environment with certain nutrients, and these little spots here represent sort of aggregations of lots and lots of organisms here. So it's formed this sort of like very regular patterns of spots or sometimes stripes as well. Okay. So that's in a species such as a bacteria. In Dictyostelium, which is an example of it's a type of amoeboidal cell, but it's much more of a demonstration of how a sort of a cell in your body moves. So Dictyostelium also exhibits chemotaxis, and it uses chemotaxis to coordinate a very, very complex life cycle. So these Dictyostelium cells, when there's a lot of food available, they sort of just exist as sort of basically selfish organisms as individuals. They move around, they eat all the nutrients, they divide, but don't communicate. But then, when they start running out of food, they go into a very, very complex and social life cycle where, through chemotaxis, they start to aggregate together. They form what's called a fruiting body. This goes on to form what's called a slug. You have a process called cell sorting going on here, where the cells sort into two populations. One of the populations will go on to form a structure called a stalk. The other cells will go on to what are called spore cells. And the idea of this process is that at the end of it, you have this fruiting body with the spores attached to the stalk cells, and then they rely basically on either some sort of wind or maybe being picked up by the foot of a passing animal to transport the spores to a more favorable location where they can go through this whole process again. So these cells use chemotaxis in a sort of a very fundamental way to ensure survival. So as I said, that's sort of like to give some motivation for the other type of model. The other type of model for morphogenesis I'm going to talk about is what's called the chemotactic model. The cells move in response to chemical gradients, and in the early 1970s, Keller and Siegel came up with a model to describe this process. So U represents the cell density. The cell density has a diffusion term. The chemotaxis is represented by here. It basically represents a negative cross diffusion type term, which results in movement up gradients in a chemical V, have some sort of cell kinetics. The chemical has diffusion, it has some sort of reaction kinetics. And this system is able to give rise to aggregation patterns. So basically, starting from a pretty well uniform population of cells, it forms patterns of cell aggregations. So this is another way of giving rise to aggregation-type patterns or patterning. Okay, I don't want to spend too much on this slide, but chemotaxis has been studied in detail by a lot of authors from a lot of different approaches, right through from microscopic up to the macroscopic-type model that I just described. And one of the major areas of work in this is trying to develop models that go from microscopic assumptions up to developing a full macroscopic model. Okay, so that's quite an extensive introduction. For the rest of this talk, I'm going to talk about a number of things. I'm going to first give a brief introduction to pigmentation patterns, and I'm going to talk about the sort of pattern formation that you get in Turing and chemotactic systems and growing domains. I'm going to then utilize that to look at modeling angelfish and zebrafish pigmentation. And finally, well, I don't think I'll probably have time to do this, but I'll talk about some more. I'll very briefly mention some of the more recent work that I'm doing on pigmentation that is looking at larval zebrafish pigmentation. Okay, so fish pigmentation patterns. So, as I said, fish pigmentation patterns are a really beautiful example of morphogenesis. You know, it's a very, very nice thing to look at, and they show remarkable diversity, huge range of them. So I've kind of showed some examples here. This is a flounder that, you know, some particularly mean marine biologists decided to try and confuse by putting on a checkerboard surface. The flounder, like the chameleon and like several other species, has got the ability to blend into the environment. And, you know, despite this sort of fairly complex sort of pattern underneath, it was able to do a pretty good job at it. You know, it's sort of replicating these sort of squares on its surface, certainly better than I could even do with a can of paint or something, I should think. So the flounder is able to blend into its environment because it doesn't usually have to sort of like deal with a checkerboard pattern in nature. This is more of its natural environment, and I don't know if anybody can see where the flounder is on that. Okay, well, the flounder and this, basically in the center here, I could only get it by sort of seeing this slight shadow here from its front or something. So it's an incredibly adept at responding to the environment and organizing. This is another, I have no idea what this fish is, it just had the most beautiful pattern that I've seen. You know, this gorgeous sort of green and yellow sort of patterns on it. And this pigmentation colouring derives from a number of cells that occur in the dermal layer of the skin. So the top layer is your epidermis, the layer below is the dermal layer. In species like fish, there's lots of different examples. There's melanophores. Melanophores give rise to sort of this black pigmentation here. Iridophores are sort of silvery reflective. They reflect the light in a certain way. Xanthophores are another that give rise to a yellow pigmentation. There's several other types as well. So fish have quite a lot of these different pigment cells, and that gives rise to all the different pigmentation patterns you see. And skin colour changes can occur either in a very rapid way, such as in these sort of flounders that you're showing here, or over much longer periods, and this is going to be shown by the angelfish that I'm about to demonstrate, and I'll talk about this latter one.
So how does the flounder look with its eyes at this
point?
Yeah. How the hell does it know that it's...
You know, every time I give this talk, somebody asks, you know, how does it do this? And I always think, okay, I've got to find this out and give a good answer, but I always forget then. It's a physiological response in the, you know, it uses hormones to control. This isn't exactly answering what you're saying, but the way it sort of is able to do this is by the pigment cells themselves that basically got these pigment granules inside, which are very, very small granules which give rise to the colour. It's able to rapidly cluster those together or disperse them to actually give the right thing.
Yeah,
but how it's actually doing it, I think it's got some sort of receptors on the surface that are able to respond to the surrounding light.
So, like receptors on the bottom that change the color on the top or something?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean,
you look, those squares light up.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I
can't be using its eyes. Can't see that part of the body.
I don't think it's really fully understood, actually. But you know, it's really a phenomenal response, isn't it? Doing that. So I'm sorry I can't give you a better answer, actually. But next time I give this talk, I really will. Okay. Okay. So models for pigmentation. Well, sort of the earliest models were basically those that Murray proposed, I think, sort of starting in the late 70s. And he proposed a Turing mechanism for pigmentation. So the idea would be that you'd have some sort of chemical reaction going on in the skin, and the pigment cells would respond to different concentrations of the chemicals to give rise to a specific patterning. It's very, very persuasive and, you know, purely based on sort of equations. So if you have got a salamander here, you do your simulations on a salamander-shaped domain, you get sort of something that looks very good. It was also able to give rise to sort of certain predictions, namely that a spotted animal could only have a striped tail and not vice versa, and various things like that that were predicted from this model. Okay. But where I got interested in this project, this problem, was very, very much in sort of like the late 90s, as a result of some work by Kondo and Asai, who studied the Quran angelfish, so a particular type of marine angelfish that shows a very beautiful pattern that also evolves as the fish is growing. So in a juvenile stage, this fish has sort of like three concentric white stripes on its body. As the fish grows, you get the number of stripes increases, new stripes emerge between the existing ones, between this one to this and this, correspond to this and this, and a new stripe will emerge between that. That process will repeat again, and you can see that during this process you get very much an age structuring to the stripes. You can see the old stripes are very sort of like thick and white, the other one, the newer stripes are thinner, the newest stripes are even thinner than that, so it's sort of age structuring to stripe. Goes through this process a couple of times, but then another problem which hasn't really been properly addressed yet is then when it approaches its adulthood, this whole pigmentation pattern will completely change. So this is very much in between juvenile and adult. The pattern, you can see the old pigment pattern is beginning to fade, and a new pattern of spots is beginning to emerge, and then an adult, it's got a completely different pattern. And this, while this juvenile pattern, it's actually similar across a lot of marine angelfish. So this is a slightly different species. The emperor angelfish, you know, it's it's a little bit more complex. You know, you actually get these sort of almost full circles on this, but you get the same sort of process going on in that you see new stripes emerging between them, between the original one. But in these, in other species, the adult pattern will be completely different. The emperor angelfish has these sort of like characteristic horizontal yellow and blue stripes. So the grey angelfish, again, it has a very similar juvenile pattern. Is a royal angelfish, and the adult pattern in each case is very, very different. But the juvenile pattern is sort of basic pattern of new stripes emerging and doubling, but the main doubles is very, very consistent. One question you could probably have here is, why does it, you know, go to all this effort? Well, the reason is these adults are extremely aggressive, they're territorial, they attack each other. So, but the juveniles are able to safely swim in the same territories as an adult male because the adult doesn't perceive the juvenile as a threat, so it's basically safe from being attacked. But you put two of these adults in the same tank, and if it's small, they'll probably kill each other. Okay, so that's angelfish pigmentation. Another type of pigmentation is zebrafish pigmentation. And again, zebrafish pigmentation shows a pattern that changes as the fish grows in size. So it has a certain larval pigmentation pattern. So the larval is very basic. It consists of three horizontal stripes, the dorsal stripe, the ventral stripe here, and the lateral stripe, which is very faint across here. That emerges in a very precise spatially and temporally regulated manner. The adult pattern is completely different again. Consists of horizontal blue and white stripes. So these blue and white stripes, the first two will emerge along the center, and then new ones are added first towards the top, then to the bottom, then to the top, then to the bottom, and again in a very precise manner. Okay, and just to show some other examples, there's lots of different examples of how patterns change as the domain. This is a species called Harlequin sweetlips. As a juvenile, it shows sort of like these big white spots on an orange background. As it grows to adult, the whole pattern completely rearranges. The adult has orange spots on a white background with a completely different wavelength. The grouper, panther grouper, again has a pattern rearrangement as it grows in size. The juvenile is sort of like the spotted pattern, and as the juvenile grows, you see sort of new spots developing in here. So these sort of ones here are new ones that are developing. The adult, again, you know, has a pattern that will eventually reemerge. This is between juvenile and adult, but in the adult, you're beginning to see these sort of very large areas of pigmentation emerging, and those will eventually dominate. Okay, so now we're talking about how to actually incorporate domain growth into the models for pigmentation. So the idea is you start off with some sort of reaction diffusion system on some constant domain. Or to incorporate domain growth, you employ Reynolds transport theorem. So for a domain evolving in time, our reaction diffusion system will be given by this equation, where U represents the fluid flow. And I think Philip Maney in tomorrow's talk will probably be talking in more detail about this aspect. But what I want to talk about today is two particular types of growth. And the first is the idea of uniform growth. So uniform growth is basically the domain that we're interested in is going to be expanding at a uniform rate across the domain. A biological idea for how that would be is, if we're talking about the skin layer, maybe the growth factor that is telling cells to divide is coming uniformly from below, and that would give rise to roughly a uniformly growing domain. The other type of growth I'll talk about is boundary growth. So in this case, the domain is growing purely by new material added at the boundary of the domain. So maybe at the end of domain, you've got a population of cells that are rapidly dividing, and that's resulting in localized expansion at one side of the domain. Okay, so in general, of course, embryonic growth is going to be highly anisotropic. You'll have different regions that are growing and expanding at a different rate. And that's an area that I know people like Philip Maney and Edmund Crampin have been working on. Okay, so let's incorporate these two types of growth into our equations. So for uniform growth on a one-dimensional domain, incorporate into our the equation we got through Reynolds' transport theorem, basically results in these two new terms in the equation. And then a quite useful trick with these sort of equations, we can use by employing a coordinate transformation where we transform our growing domain onto a domain of constant size through this coordinate transformation. We actually get an equation where we lose the convective term up here. We have an additional term in our reaction diffusion system, this term here that can be thought of a dilution term. That's sort of like the loss of chemical as the domain is expanding, and the effect of the growing domain comes in this now this temporally evolving diffusion coefficient. So the diffusion coefficient changes over time. Okay. For boundary growth, where you do the same, you can do the same sort of analysis. The resulting equation is actually quite different in this case. We get an additional term to our reaction diffusion system. We get the same temporally varying diffusion coefficient, but we also get this convective term that is resulting from the domain expanding in time. And as I say, there's Edmund Crampin and Philip Main have studied these models in a lot of detail. Okay, so if we incorporate this into a Turing model, so we're going to consider a uniformly growing one-dimensional domain, put this into our Turing model. For the rest of this, certainly for nearly all the simulations I show in this talk, we're going to use Schnackenberg chemical kinetics. It's one of the standard mechanisms that give rise to Turing pattern formation with this set of parameter values. But what do we get in our simulations? Well, under certain conditions, we get a very precise sequence of peak doubling. So this shows the spatial-temporal sequence of evolution. Starting on a small domain, initially we get one half peak occurring. As the domain grows in time, that emerges to a full peak, goes to two peaks, goes to four peaks, and the spatial wavelength is roughly conserved during this process. I say that's generally quite a robust sequence. It does, you can get slightly different evolutions. It maybe doesn't go through this peak doubling by changing, for example, the growth rate or other sorts of things. But this is actually a very, very robust sequence of patterns. Okay. What sort of patterns do we get for the chemotaxis model? Okay. So we just do the same process. We incorporate our growing domain into our chemotaxis model, the Keller-Seegan model I talked about before. U is the cell density, V is the chemoattractant concentration. Choice of chemical kinetics, we have production of the chemical by the cells and some degradation of the chemical. This chi of V is called the chemotactic sensitivity. I use what's called the receptor law, which is a commonly used form of chemotactic sensitivity. It's not really that important in terms of the simulations I show. And basically, with these chemical kinetics, this system will give rise to pattern formation, and you can see how that will occur as follows. The cells are producing the chemical. They're then moving up gradients in the chemical, so it's sort of a reinforcing mechanism. And a standard linear stability analysis on this model will predict that pattern formation occurs for certain parameters. Principally, the size of this chemotactic sensitivity is one of the most important things. Okay. Well, because probably some of you are less familiar about the sort of patterns you get in chemotaxis systems, I'll just show some numerics for a constant domain for the chemotaxis problem. You get the same sort. So this is for no cell kinetics and no cell division is occurring. So on a constant domain, you get a pattern of peaks in the cell density, pattern of peaks in the chemoattractant concentration, and for low time, it looks like it sort of remains fairly constant, much in the same way as you'd get for a Turing pattern system. But this set of equations actually gives rise to much different patterning over the long term. So over the long term, it gives rise to a process of coarsening. So these early two cell density peaks here and here sort of have joined together to form a single one. Another two join together at this point here. Other ones slowly coarsen. And if you run this over a very long time, the number of peaks gradually decreases until you'll be eventually left with a single peak at the boundary. So while the short-term dynamics are very similar to the Turing model, the long-term dynamics are very different. It's also very sensitive according to the type of cell kinetics you choose. So I'm choosing cell kinetics, which is basically a logistic growth. It's a standard model for how cells divide. Again, you get the pattern formation occurring in the short term. So you get peaks that peaks in the cell density and in the chemical concentration. But over long term, well, you do get a sort of coarsening process going on. So you're getting this coarsening where two peaks join into a single peak here, but then you get a constant insertion of new stripes as well over a while as well. So this pattern just sort of carries on over a long time. So it gives very, very different long-term behavior compared to the Turing model. Okay. So what about what sort of patterns do we get with the chemotaxis system when we incorporate domain growth? So when we did it in the Turing pattern, we got this very nice sequence of stripe insertion frequency doubling. For the chemotaxis system, we appear to lose this behavior. So we initially get the pattern of peaks forming. As the domain grows, we're not yet seeing any new stripes emerging. Well, I haven't expanded the domain much at the moment, but if I continue to do it, you never seem to get new stripes emerging. So the number of peaks that initially form continue to remain over time. So this is an example of what we'd call scale invariant patterning. And actually, that's pretty important when it comes to developmental biology. For example, if in the angelfish, of course, we do actually want this process of the number of stripes doubling in time. But for a lot of things, we don't really want two hearts or four hearts, you know, so as the embryo grows, we need some sort of scale invariance. So this mechanism gives a way of doing it. Okay. Well, for those equations there, I wasn't actually considering any particular cell kinetics. Really, in this model, we'd actually need to consider that if we're talking about an embryo, if the embryo is growing, you need some sort of source for new cells in your model. Well, you can actually think of multiple ways that new cells may come. One would be that the existing cells are dividing. Simple assumption for this would be just some sort of exponential growth in your cell population. The other sort of idea would be that instead of sort of division of the existing cells, then instead you've got some sort of underlying stem cell population. So the stem cell population divides and gives rise to the particular cells that are involved in the chemotactic mechanism, in which case we just have a constant production of new cells. How do these two assumptions affect the patterning? As I say, when we just have the existing cells dividing, so just these cells here are the ones that are undergoing division, you get this sort of type scale invariant patterning that we have, where the number of initial peaks remains over time as the domain grows. The slide was actually in the wrong order. Just to show the effect of the growth rate when we incorporate this, well, the growth rate actually also has a fairly strong impact on the pattern that emerges. So for low growth rates, we get just a few peaks developing. At larger growth rates, we seem to get more peaks in the developing. Okay. The other idea was that we have proliferation of new cells arising from the precursor population, in which case for our cell kinetics we just take as a constant, so new cells are coming into the domain everywhere. And in this case, we now sort of rescue the idea of this sort of peak doubling going on. So new cells are coming into everywhere, new peaks come into the system between the existing one, and that process continues to go on. So with the chemotaxis system seems to be a lot more diverse than the Turing model in that you can get both this sort of scale invariant patterning and peak doubling with the domain growth depending on what your assumptions are for how your cells are dividing. Okay, so now we're coming on to actually the application of this modeling to the angelfish. So just to remind you of this sequence in patterning, so as I said earlier, this was This was first really noticed by Condor and Asai in 1995. Basically, they noticed this sort of very unusual pattern evolution in the fish. They proposed a simple Turing system that described the angelfish pigmentation. They were able to demonstrate that in the juvenile stages that you get this peak doubling process that you is characteristic of the Turing system. They also looked at aspects of the adult stripe organization through a Turing system, and they concluded that a Turing system was controlling this sequence. Okay. So this is where I kind of got into the problem originally. And we basically looked at the original paper, and there was a number of things that it was missing. And to extend the modeling, we decided to consider a more detailed model where you actually start considering the dynamics of the pigment cells involved. So one question you could have is, what is the origin of the stripes, or Condor and Asai proposed Turing-type mechanism for generating the striped pattern? But, you know, chemotaxis is also a valid model for that, possibly. The other question would be, where do your new pigment cells come from? So does it occur through division of the existing pigment cells, or are we getting sort of generation of new pigment cells from some sort of pigment cell precursors, so stem cells, if you want to call them that. So pigment cells come as a result of another population of stem cells. And finally, how are these new pigment cells positioned? So where do they locate in the skin? Well, one idea would be if you have a population of stem cells that can give rise to the different pigment cells, one idea would be they differentiate into a certain pigment cell according to the local chemical concentration. And that was effectively the idea that Condor and Asai had. The Turing pattern creates a pattern, and then the cells simply respond to that by dividing in a certain way. Another possibility would be that some sort of directed migration or chemotaxis is actually responsible for then guiding the cells to, in response to the chemical gradients, to a specific location in the skin. Okay. So we wanted to incorporate these sort of like address some of these questions. We came up with a chemotaxis-based model where we incorporate the pigment cell dynamics. For simplicity, in this model, we're going to just assume two principal pigment cells that are giving rise to this sort of juvenile pattern of the black and white stripes, the melanophores and the iridophores. And that's sort of fairly established evidence. There's actually more pigment cells involved in reality, but those are the two dominant ones. We're going to assume that there's some population of a pigment cell precursor, so some sort of stem cell type cell that is able to give rise, that when it divides is able to give rise to either a melanophore or a iridophore, depending on its environmental information. There's quite a lot of evidence for that as well. And finally, I'm going to assume that cells have the capacity to move chemotactically in response to a chemical. And again, well, you know, it's certainly not concrete, but there is quite a lot of evidence that that's actually going on. Okay. So we can consider a couple of different types. So this is just sort of a schematic to show our model. We're assuming everything's happening in the dermal layer of the skin. In this layer, there's some sort of chemical reaction and diffusion going in. There's a population of undifferentiated pigment cells that give rise to the differentiated melanophores or iridophores. Well, two principal models that you consider are as follows. If you have this darker shaded region indicates a higher chemical concentration. So in the idea where the positioning of new pigment cells is just based on the chemical concentration, there's no chemotaxis involved, those stem cells divide. If they're in a high concentration region, maybe they give rise to iridophores. If they're in a lower concentration, they give rise to maybe melanophores. That's the idea of positioning based on differentiation alone. The idea of chemotaxis would be that in addition, these stem cells, well, they can divide into either, it doesn't matter what the concentration is, but then they migrate according to the chemotaxis, according to the chemical concentration. So this aridophore here, it migrates in a region of low chemical concentration, so it differentiates in the region of low chemical concentration, but then it migrates to the high gradient through chemotaxis. Okay, so all of those assumptions can be put into a sort of a simple 1D model, incorporate the melanophores, the iridophores, and some sort of generic chemical reaction for the chemicals. F and G represent how the new pigment cells are derived from the precursor cells. H represents the reaction kinetics for the chemicals. Well, in this model, because these equations for the melanophores and iridophores, there's not going to be any interactions between them. So actually, we can actually ignore at least one of our pigment cell populations. It's not really necessary to include it. So I'm going to ignore the melanophores. So the questions I want to explore are, how reliable are different pattern mechanisms in generating the correct patterning we see in the angelfish? So specifically, we'll look at whether or not a Turing mechanism or the chemotactic mechanism is likely to give rise to the correct patterns of new peaks. Second one is, can the positioning of the cells based on differentiation from precursor cells give rise to the correct patterning? Or can positioning based on chemotaxis from precursor cells give rise to the correct patterning? And finally, when we extend this to 2D, do we actually get the same sort of patterning going? So is the pattern robust to more complicated geometries? Okay, and ideally, the model that we want to, that we should sort of get should be robust. It should give us sort of a robust process of new stripes emerging, doubling as the domain doubles in size. Should give rise to what I call these age-structured stripes, that you can see the clear difference in the stripes. And finally, it should show the sort of pattern features that we see in 2D. Okay, so in the first sort of case, I'm going to look at the idea that the underlying pattern generator, if that's what you want to call it, so what's responsible for giving rise to these angelfish stripes, is a Turing system. So we have a system of chemicals U and V. They basically behave as a Turing system. I'm using the Schnackenberg kinetics as before. And then the iridophores simply can respond chemotactically to one of the chemicals in this, and they also proliferate, maybe also depending on the chemicals in this thing. But the actual thing that's driving the pattern formation is the Turing system. I'm going to assume a domain that's growing exponentially in time. You can get reasonable values for the growth rates based on the data from how the angelfish grow and various other parameters labeled there. Okay, so the first thing is just to look at what happens if the generation of our new iridophore cells is simply taken as a constant. So that's basically assuming that there's the generation of new pigment cells doesn't even depend on the chemical concentration. But in that case, you don't actually get any sort of patterning for the cells. The Turing system, meanwhile, is undergoing its sort of period doubling. So you clearly, and I should also say there's no chemotaxis going in this, so there's no cell movement. That's really just a test simulation. Okay. So if we assume that the new pigment cells that are arriving are becoming a particular type of pigment cell based on the chemical concentration, so I assume a linear form for this, well, that begins to give rise to something that looks roughly right. You have the chemical concentration undergoing its period doubling, new pigment cells come into the skin, and they're forming sort of like the right sort of stripe insertion things, but it's all a little bit fuzzy. It's not really nice and clear like you see in the patterns on the skin. You can change the sort of form that you choose for your how it depends. So if you choose some sort of heavy side function where you've got some threshold going on, so the cells differentiating into iridophores for a certain minimal chemical concentration, But you get, again, you do get a sort of stripe doubling process going on. Again, it's still not particularly robust. And you don't really get the nice sort of age-structured new stripes in this model. Okay. So the conclusion from those two or three slides alone is that if you have your differentiation purely based on, if you have your positioning of your new pigment cells purely based on the chemical concentrations and no chemotaxis, well, sort of could give rise to it, but it's not very close. Let's add in the chemotaxis movement. So now, rather than assuming that the cells are differentiating based on the chemical concentration, I'm also assuming once they differentiate, they move to sites in the skin based on a chemotaxis mechanism. And that actually gives something that looks a lot better in regards to the angelfish pigmentation. We get clear stripes forming corresponding to these, to the chemical concentration. Then new cells come in, form stripes, and however much you grow this domain, you get a clear age structuring in that these stripes are much larger than the new one that emerges, and so on. So you get something that looks very close, at least in 1D, to the 2D angelfish. You can combine that with the idea of some concentration-dependent generation of precursors, and that gives very, very similar results. Okay. That was for a Turing system giving rise to the underlying pattern. The other idea would be to assume that the actual pattern generator is a chemotaxis-driven system. So we don't have an underlying Turing system. We have some sort of chemotaxis system, much like the Keller-Siegel model I showed before. But when you do that, you do get some sort of peak insertion going on. You get new stripes coming in. You do get the age structuring, but it turns out that this isn't actually very robust. You know, despite sort of the domain growing from something fairly small to something like I think 10 times its initial size, we only actually see the appearance of a couple of new stripes. So it's not this sort of nice robust. The number of stripes is doubling as the domain doubles in size that you get in the Turing system. So in conclusion, the chemotaxis system is probably not really as robust as the Turing system. Okay. And also, this just shows some of the other examples for this. In other cases, you don't even get this peak insertion going on. Okay. So to conclude from that, from the model, it seems that the Turing-driven type of mechanism of generating the pattern would be the most reliable in predicting the sequence. But the positioning of the new cells as they differentiate is very difficult to obtain just by differentiation alone. You need to add some sort of chemotaxis or some sort of directed migration to get a good correspondence with the biology. Okay, so the final couple of minutes, I'll just sort of talk about how we extend this into two dimension. For the extension to two dimension, I'm just going to choose the best model from the one-dimensional simulation. So we assume a Turing mechanism is driving the pattern, and then chemotaxis-directed movement of pigment cells organizes them into stripes. What I'd like to show is that we get a nice, robust 2D stripe pattern. We'll get the correct patterning with different geometries, and a transformation into adult pigment patterns. Okay. And the good news, it works in two dimensions as well. So we've got a two-dimensional domain. These are actually growing from this one to this one to this one. In this set of simulations, I've actually used a logistic uniform growth. So rather than continuously growing over time, I'm having something that grows to a constant size eventually. In the early stages, you see new stripes emerging between the original ones. That occurs a couple of times, depending on how large you grow it. And for this particular parameter set, we also get something that looks like the transformation to the adult as well. So as the domain approaches its maximum size, this regular pattern of stripes starts to become disrupted until eventually it forms a spotted pattern. So it's also looking like it's showing certain characteristics of the the correct transformation in the adult as well. Okay. This was for, as I said, logistic uniform growth, and I've used Seaman reaction kinetics. But the reason I use Seaman reaction kinetics here is because the kinetics turn out to be very important in two dimensions. So for other kinetic type schemes like the Schnackenberg kinetics I did earlier, you don't get a pattern of stripes forming, instead it forms spotted patterns, it said. You get other, you can also do this on a much more realistic domain. So this is my fish-like geometry, because biologists don't like spherical corals or rectangular fish. So do it on that. Seems to give the same sort of patterning going on as well.
How do you grow it?
It's simply a 2D version of the same problem. So it's uniform growth everywhere, and so you're actually doing this by just the diffusion coefficients changing in time. Okay. But as I indicated before, actually, the 2D problem is actually much more. You get a lot of other different patterns going on as well. So I already said that the reaction kinetics play an important part. So for certain reaction kinetics, you may get spots. Another thing that can happen, well, if you start on a bigger domain, you don't get a nice regular stripe pattern forming initially. Instead, it may form, these are sort of stripes, but they're sort of like form this very labyrinthine pattern. And of course, when domain grows, you don't get this sort of nice regular sequence going on. But that's not really a problem, because in various fish, you get those sort of patterns going on anyway. So this is a rat. You can see these sort of very labyrinthian type patterns here. This is a puffer fish that's also showing these sort of behaviours. So, okay. So, well, because it's about 12:30, I just wrap up. I've got quite a bit of other things that we're working on. So just to give you an idea of where we're going on this. Well, the angelfish is it's a beautiful example of the coupling between pattern formation and growth. The problem with it, certainly if you're a developmental biologist, is they grow very large, so the eventual size they grow is about probably around 2 foot, 24 inches. They grow slowly, it takes about 2 years to get there. They're territorial, so if you put two in the same tank, they'll kill each other. Finally, they just sort of seem to die out of spite as well, actually. You get the chemical, you get your sort of like your environment slightly wrong, the right sort of saline content, and they're really temperamental to that. So, conclusion is a developmental biologist is not going to be interested in this, So, a much more suitable lab animal is, of course, the zebrafish. And the zebrafish has a lot of advantages for studying pigmentation. One is it's fairly transparent at early stages, but importantly, the pigment cells have their own marker. They have the pigment. So you can actually see very clearly the movement of the pigment cells in the larval stages. Grows very quickly, so it grows in 40 days, and there's a lot of mutants identified. It's widely studied, and it also shows sort of like remarkably diverse patterns across related species. So this shows a number of pigment mutants that show various patterns, sort of including spots. It shows some related species which show similar but slightly different patterns. So it's a much, much more interesting, or it's a much more suitable system for studying pattern formation and pigmentation growth. But as I said, because time's probably fairly close, I'll actually leave it there, and thank you very much for your attention.
Questions?
Have they sequenced the zebrafish, and are they prepared to mess with its genes to produce different mutants for you?
Well, they've certainly produced lots and millions of mutants. I don't think they've completely sequenced it.
It has been completely, okay. Right. It's,
yeah, but I mean, it's certainly, I know to say, I mean, you know, Pigmentation is actually probably one of the fairly well studied types of pattern formation that's going on because of its advantages and things. My eventual hope is to get onto this sort of modelling at the adult stages. What I'm currently first looking at, though, is actually looking at modelling the larval pattern that I showed earlier. So, but there's a huge amount of data with which to work. There's sort of very good specific data in terms of the growth of them and how they're growing and things like that. So it's all very nicely set up for really studying these sort of problems.
I'm slightly confused when you were talking about the coarsening in the
moths.
You're saying over longer time scales.
Yes.
You get the phenomenon in coarsening, and yet later.
That one there.
Yeah, when you then apply it to the growing domain.
Yeah, it is.
You then get the scale invariant. Now, what's the trade-off between the time you need to wait coarsening to happen versus the time over which the system is growing?
I haven't really, I mean, because I've only sort of like recently been getting into this sort of area, so I can't really give you a proper answer. You can get some sort of insight. With what's happening in this particular simulation here. This was taking the model which would, with the constant domain, give rise to coarsening. But here I'm looking with a growing domain. Then here I changed the growth rate, and that affected the number of patterns that I got here. So for a very slowing domain, growing domain, I'm getting a pattern of sort of, well, two peaks actually, two boundary peaks and one middle one. And I think what's happening there is that one of the domains growing very slowly initially, you actually are getting that coarsening going on. So it's going through a proof process until, for some reason, at this sort of point, the domain gets so large, and I guess, because this coarsening is somehow dependent on the fact that there's always some communication between these peaks, because they're releasing chemoattractant, that's diffusing, but that's becoming too large for the cells actually to move together. And it seems, this does seem very robust, actually, carry on growing it, and it always seems to be curved. But I haven't really looked at it closely enough to give you any more than that.
Yeah, in the same direction. Did I understand now correctly that if you start with the coarsened data, and then you let the domain grow, then you get this coarsening, splitting, or coarsening insertion kind of. What was the
difference? The other one. You mean that picture? I can actually show you a simulation of that. So this is okay. So this is actually a simulation of that process going on. You get all these peaks, and then new ones seem to be coming in, and then they merge together and collapse. Again, it's something that I've only fairly recently been looking at, it's to do with other areas, but so what was...
So maybe I can ask more precisely, was that what you just showed us under growing?
No. So this is done on a constant domain. The difference was, in this case, I was actually incorporating some sort of cell kinetics. Okay. So for that first process where there was just the coarsening going on, there was nothing. Here I was incorporating some sort of logistic growth. So the cells sort of divide, but there's no actual coupling between the kinetics and the chemical. You've got probably a similar mechanism that's giving rise to this coarsening. But as soon as those peaks sort of become sufficiently far apart, that gives basically enough space for new cells to divide through the division, and they come into it or something. But it seems that the fact that the kinetics don't depend on the chemical concentration is crucial, because if for the chemical kinetics you sort of introduce a dependence on the chemical concentration here to make this, say, U times V at the front here, then you lose immediately that this sort of peak insertion going on. So.
Slightly wider issue. There's a lot of modeling that goes on trying to say, well, okay, under these conditions, we can replicate these types of patterns. So a lot of the energy seems to be going into developing models that generate certain types of patterns. And you can show that, you know, different, like your chemotactic versus your Turing pattern.
Right.
What kinds of blades can. There seems to be very little effort going on at the other end of actually saying, how can we really try and nail down atypically what mechanisms generate what patterns? Can you say something about?
That's a fairly valid criticism, I think that, you know, that's why I originally moved away from the angelfish, because you can make predictions with that. But you know, nobody's actually really going to do that. In fact, there was another theoretician that was a guy called Babio that was also working on this problem. Actually, went to the extent of trying to grow the angelfish himself, so he could actually answer some of these questions for himself. Unfortunately, as I said, because of these problems that they grow slowly and they die easily, he found his entire life was dominated just trying to keep these guys alive. That's why I'm very interested in going into zebrafish pigmentation, because there you can actually make some reasonable predictions. So this is a problem to do with how the zebrafish is growing. So the zebrafish tail, you get this like pattern going on here, where new stripes are always inserted at the far end of this grown domain. So forms this one here, then it forms the next one, forms here, and so on. Or you can actually do experiments where you basically cut off the tail. The zebrafish is actually able to regrow this, and it grows it basically in the same way each time or something. And you can use this sort of modeling, then to make actual predictions about how maybe this domain is growing. So I talked about the idea of sort of boundary growth and uniform growth. Uniform growth wouldn't give rise to the right sort of sequence. It shows this period doubling. But you choose a particular type of domain growth so that the idea would be that the fin is regrowing by division going on at the end of the fin. So that's where everything's going. And that's the only one that seems to give rise to the right sort of pattern. So you can actually make some sort of predictions, but the angelfish is not the system to be doing this in. You've got to be choosing a much more suitable model.
Okay, thank Kevin again.